Harihita Sahana Bhavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Saha Veyam Karabhavahai Tejasvi Navadhitamastu Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadara Shri Vasari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare.
Okay, page 8.
Or should we leave the bottom of the stack?
Yeah, more.
Yeah. Then the question is, where is the bottom? Yes.
Okay. Page 8. Where's the bottom? Sri Balade Vidyabhushana elaborates on Jiva's exposition of the principle of oneness. Statements of extreme non-difference of the Jiva and the Lord in statements of apposition, e.g., you are that, indicate similarity of type only, since the Jiva is a form of consciousness like the Lord. In that sense, there is oneness of Jiva with Brahman. Footnote 8. If someone says that Texans and New Yorkers are one, we understand that he means that they are both American, not that they have no separate existence. Just thinking that the New Yorkers would appreciate it. You could say, those from, you know, how you say, the east side of Central Park and those from the west side of Central Park are one.
Yes. Yeah.
The distinct differences are obvious. This is shown through examples. Some statement in the Upanishads speak of the Lord with amshas. So kamayata bahusham, the Lord desired, may I be many. There are also statements in the Upanishads showing the Lord without amshas. Because here is that the Lord is saying, he may I be many. So the point is if the impersonalist, then they would say that manyness is an illusion. So then how would this be a statement of the Upanishads, which is supposed to be transcendental? Mm-hmm. Right? So it shouldn't arise, yes.
Is it also not limiting the Lord, and he can be one, but he can be also many, so why they say only one?
Yes, of course. It's just because it's the thing with the Mayavadis or the Buddhists, it's not actually about the absolute truth, it's about their own position, that they'll be happy. That's all. It's not really about the Lord. So that's the point, is there's no devotion. And so they're not actually interested in the supreme absolute truth in total, just enough to benefit themselves. That's all they're looking for. Right? And so then you are that means that is the quality that one is. Right? It's not that. It means, in other words, we are Brahman like the Lord. In other words, there's the point of consciousness. Right? As we were saying about jnana, is about the consciousness. Right? Right? And then it says that Brahman is jnana. So they're saying knowledge is illusion. Right? So then the difficulty comes is knowledge being, if knowledge is illusion, how can Brahman be that? So they contradict their own statements with the particular quotes that they use. There are also statements in the Upanishad showing the Lord without amshas. Satyam jnanam anantam. Brahman is eternal existence and knowledge. Taittiriya Upanishad 2.1.1. Nishkalam nishkriyam santam niravadyam niranjanam. The Lord is without parts, without action, peaceful, without fault, without contamination. Sweta Sutara Upanishad 6.19, footnote 9. Baladeva Dibhushan clarifies the meaning of these seemingly monistic passages from the Upanishads. They simply focus on Brahman in abstract, in isolation, not paying attention to his personality, expansions, and companions. Indeed, the personality of Godhead has no material parts, nothing that we can take away from or added to him. He does not engage in material karma. He is free from the agitations of material desire, and he is never degraded by contact with Maya. Clearly, this passage does not undermine the fundamental tenets of bhakti. Shrutis which describe the Lord without amsas aim at defining the object apart from its distinct descriptive elements. They speak of Brahman without revelation of its form and qualities. Okay, so you're just establishing the nature of the Supreme, that particular aspect. Then, as Rupa was mentioning, then you have the completeness, where you describe everything. But because he is complete, there's nothing to take away, or nothing to add. He is, being everything, right? Then that means that all these amsas and that are also him. So it doesn't distract. 52.1 continued. The Supreme is called Brahman because it is, quote, the greatest, Brihattama, in terms of its essential self and its energies. And so the jiva is spoken of in relation with the Supreme when it's said that the jiva, quote, accompanies that Brahman, end quote, and that Brahman enters matter, quote, along with this jiva's soul, end quote. Anena jivatmaneti, Chandogya Upanishad. 6.3.2. Although the adjective this in the phrase this jiva indicates that the jiva is separate from Brahman, that the jiva is called soul, so that he has a special relationship of substantial oneness with Brahman. Right? So the jiva indicates the difference, the soul indicates the similarity. So you get both. That's the point. The Upanishads will bring out both. Srila Baladeva Vidyabhushan comments, in the Lord's statement in Chandogya Upanishad 6.3.2, the word anena signifies that the jiva, atma, refers to the jiva who is an amsa of the supreme atma. The Lord's separate amsa, vibhinamsa, not a form like matsya, which is a svamsa. Right? So you have amsa and svamsa. So he's just pointing out the difference there. 52.1 continued. In trance, Bhadarayana Vyasa perceived all this reasoning, which established that the jiva is not absolutely one with the Supreme. The word Sri Bhagavatam, in a preceding verse, Bhagavatam 12.13.9, establishes that the verse under discussion, 12.13.12, indeed refers to Srimad Bhagavatam. 52.2. Suppose someone who has been kept prisoner in his house since birth wants to know what the sun is. Someone shows him the sun's rays happening to come through the small holes in the closed window shutters and tells him, that is the sun. Behind this answer lies this instruction. From these small portions of light, which are one in substance with their source, you should be able to form some idea of the great fiery sphere of the sun. Does that make sense? Right? Yes? No? It means like here, we're not seeing the sun, but the light is coming in. So when you see the rays of the sunlight coming in, you can say, that's the sun. Because from that you can get an idea of the sun. So that's what it's talking about when it talks about Brahman and these aspects. In the same way, the jiva is a portion of the Supreme by virtue of the Supreme's inconceivable special potencies. This we will prove later in the Paramatma Sandarbha. So now it's just the business is to establish the position of Bhagavatam. Because that's what's going to be quoted for everything throughout the Sandarbhas. In this section of Tattva Sandarbha that Srila Jiva Goswami, gives one of the central analogies illustrating the philosophy of Chintabheda Veda Tattva. 52.3. In places, the Upanishads teach that the Supreme has parts, in terms of being qualified by the jivas and other kinds of expansions. Footnote 10. Quote, Maya, please understand, is material nature, and the magician who possesses Maya is the Supreme Lord. The souls who are part and parcel of him fill the entire created world. Svetasvatara Upanishad 4.10. Shruti statements that say the Supreme has no parts deal with Kevala, the exclusive oneness of the Supreme. In the fourth line of Bhagavatam, 12.13.12, quote, the goal of this literature is exclusive oneness. The word oneness, kaivalya, refers simply to pureness. As we will explain later in the Priti Sandarbha, the statement of pureness is ultimately pure bhakti. Here Jiva Goswami makes clear that the term kaivalyaika prayojanam, Srimad Bhagavatam 12.13.12, does not refer to the jivas merging into the impersonal Brahman. As should be clear by now, this is impossible since there's no such thing as impersonal Brahman in the way the Mayavadis intend. Logically, impersonal Brahman cannot exist, because to exist would require the attribute of existence, which implies potency, which in turn implies duality. Brahman puts plus attributes. Hence, in no Vedic literature does the word Brahman have the meaning of impersonal Brahman in the sense that the Mayavadis use it. Instead, what we learn in Bhagavatam is that Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan are the names given to the non-dual substance, Brahmeti, Paramatmeti, Bhagavan iti, Shabdite, Srimad Bhagavatam 1-11. To various types of transcendentalists, the same absolute truth appears in different ways, but the absolute truth itself remains unchanged. This is significant of the word shabdite, is sounded or is worded. Right? Rather, Jiva Goswami asserts that the true meaning of Kaivalya is pureness, or the sublime mystery of pure devotional service. The ultimate goal and prime necessity of existence is Krishna Prema. It is the underlying purpose of the Vedas and the Srimad Bhagavatam. It is the underlying purpose of the Vedas, and the Srimad Bhagavatam culminates in its revelation. Jiva Goswami mentions that he will discuss pure bhakti later. Okay, so the oneness then is the aspect of pureness, that the Lord is the Supreme Pure. And he does everything out of his affection and everything for the living entities. So that is how the living entities therefore deal with the Lord, right? In that pureness. So that's the platform of oneness, is where they're both dealing on the platform of pure devotion. Right? The Lord has that pure devotion to his living entities, and the living entities have that pure devotion to him. In the meantime, it is still necessary to explain the characteristics of the self. In this Anucheda, Jiva Goswami has described the relationship between the scriptures and Brahman possessing qualities. But before one can know the highest entity, the Supersoul, one must first understand the nature of the soul. 3.2b. Understanding the absolute truth by understanding the Jiva. 53-55.
Why would this be necessity? If they're qualitatively the same?
Just so you know exactly what is the soul, so you can tell. Because otherwise, they're trying to say the element of the oneness, so you're pointing out what exactly that means. You know, so what is the same, what is different? So qualities are the same. You know, size and that is different. So it is. Baladeva Vibhushana encapsulates this verse by explaining, it is said that if the jiva is understood as atma, paramatma can be easily understood. For that purpose, the author gives quotations while describing the jiva. Text 53. Very concise. Exact. This is like Buddha's lecture of the rose.
He pointed at it.
No, because everybody came, sat and all that. When it came this time to talk, he held up a rose and didn't say anything the whole time, just sat there holding it. And so everybody, I mean, the speculation that went on was like amazing. Because everyone said, he meant this, he meant that. You know, it was really a happening. They talked, you know, they're still talking about it 2,500 years later. Like, that was only a line. 53.1. Continuing in this line of thought, if one first considers the entity you, that is, the jiva soul, to be conscious and eternal, one can then easily understand the entity that, the supreme, to be similar in nature. Right? Because then you have you are that. Right? So you have to describe what is you, and you have to describe what is that. Right? To inform us of this idea, the Bhagavatam states that the jiva soul partakes of the Supreme's qualities. Thus, the Bhagavatam follows the logic found in the Vedanta Sutras. Anyartas cha paramarshaha. This consideration is for the sake of understanding the other, the Supreme, Vedanta Sutra 1320. The Upanishads give the strategy of realizing oneself as a step towards realizing the Supreme. Baladeva Vibhushana explains that this Sutra 1320 refers to the meditation, vidya, on subtle space, dahara, which he relates as follows. He quotes from the Bhamra Sutra, the Daharya Vidya in Chandogya Upanishad says, in the city of Brahman there is a small lotus dwelling. That dwelling is small. In that place, there is an inner space. Within that space is that which should be sought. Chandogya Upanishad 8.1.1. This is Vedic.
Yes.
it has its own kind of like poetry and all that. So anything that people get into these kind of like head space, you know, you're not going to get much better than this.
Hybrid.
Yeah. The body of the worshipper is the city of Brahman. In that body, one should meditate on Paramatma in the space situated in the lotus of the heart. It is taught that one should seek out that form endowed with eight qualities, starting with freedom from sin. Footnote 11. The eight qualities are freedom from sin, freedom from old age, freedom from sorrow, freedom from hunger, freedom from hunger. So that was a very important one. Freedom from thirst, satya kama, and satya sankalpa. That means true desire and true determination. Right? So we got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Okay. Must have been his disciple was very hungry. Freedom from hunger. Jiva can study within himself these eight perfections of the Supreme as they gradually appear within himself with the progress of self-realization. The spirit soul in his own pure heart, sanctified by these qualities, can find the original source of all divine qualities, the personality of Godhead. This is the conclusion. In that section, there is also the following. Receiving realization rising from this body, he attains the supreme light. and manifest with his own form. The Lord is the Supreme Person. Sandogya Upanishad 8.12.3. Receiving realization and completely clear, samprasada, the jiva attains the supreme light, which is the supreme person, uttama purusha. Why is the jiva discussed in Dahara Vidya? Brahma Sutra 1.3.20 says, quote, jiva is discussed for another purpose. The jiva attaining paramatma attains his surup for the purpose of knowing paramatma, sa uttama purusha. Because right, actually no paramatma, you have to know him as a person. So then your own position has to be established as servant. Because right, when we say sarup, then we mean servant to the Lord. That's the actual sarup. Because as we remember when Bhaktivinoda Thakur was talking about sarup siddhi, that sarup siddhi was based on the principles. You understand the mood of service. That's there. Then after that, then there's the specifics of the form. Does that make sense? Like that. So that's then how one is adjusting with the practices on the Uttama platform. So it's okay. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Because mostly we take it as the body, but remember it means the Brahma Samhita. Then the form is after the mood. Right? Means the different devotees, then they have that particular mood towards that love for Krishna. Then they manifest a form that matches that.
Yes.
Yes.
Like that. So that's the whole thing. That's first. So that's sarup.
Yes.
You know, not the form. That's how this is sahajis and babajis and all that pointed out to be. Is that it's the form. But it's not the form that makes the service, it's the attitude of service that the jiva has that makes for service. And then because that pure attitude, therefore then they have the pure body in which they can render that service. Mm-hmm. Yes.
This usual kanishtha misunderstanding that if you push people into the form that you use to get this bath, then they will automatically also have that bath.
Yeah, no, it's just
whatever service you're doing, everybody should
do. Yeah, means it's not that the situation doesn't have an influence, but we have to remember that people, because of what they want to do, create the situation, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, which came first, the bathroom or the desire to take a bath? You understand?
Yeah.
People want to take a bath, so they create a bathroom. No?
Yes.
So everything works like that. The kitchen's there because people want to eat. It wasn't that nobody was eating and everything. They were perfectly fine, and then someone made a kitchen. And then somehow or another people thought, well, that's novel. You know, hey, we could eat. You know? So, you understand? So it didn't...
They just didn't eat before.
Yes, they just didn't eat before. Right? Yes.
Maharaj, the mood of devotee should be please the Lord.
Yes, and through service. Like that. So that's the principle. So when it says here, surup, the jiva attaining paramatma attains the surup for the purpose of knowing paramatma. So he attains then that mood of service. So then from that may follow the spiritual form. You understand? But in other words, situations follow the desire.
So the desire for... to develop the mood of pure service comes first, and then it's manifest.
Yes, because otherwise how it will manifest, right? Because from desire comes endeavor, right? So unless there's desire, how will there be endeavor? What's the need of a form if you don't have, if you're not going to make an endeavor, and you won't make an endeavor unless there's desire? That makes sense. Like that. So that's the whole point. So desire is there, but when it becomes need, then you can say that it becomes proper. So that's the point. The gopis might have desire, but until that comes to complete desire, then you know, when there's that need, then the service works properly. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Yes.
That makes sense.
Yes.
Yes.
And that means one doesn't take a birth in Gokul until one has first developed the mood of one of the residents of Vrindavan.
No, but it's that you're not going to be able to use your... means if you're on this side, you have to develop the mood because it's not that the form is not the important element. You can, because you can serve whatever the form is, whatever the situation is.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's why before, despite the whatever it is, the rice husking machine, it does its service no matter whether it's in heaven or hell. You put rice in it, it husks it. Right? So that's the point. So the devotee is serving the Lord, no matter what the situation.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Right. Like that. Then the point is if you're born into Gokul, then you have a spiritual form, but that's based on the nature of desire that's there. You know what I'm saying? But what we're referring to there is that until you have the attitude, then there's no meaning to that form. Right? Because without the right attitude, you won't be able to use it in that particular way. You know what I'm saying? You can, you know, cook lunch for the family, make some cow dung patties, take care of the kids around the house, but you're not going to be able to dance with Krishna.
Yeah.
You understand? So there's more than just the physical form. That's what we're meaning. So Sarup is, the physical form has an attitude. So when that's together, then it's complete. Does that make sense? So it can mean that the jiva in meditation on the Paramatma attains the Sarup of the wanting to serve, and therefore takes up the devotional process. As we see, the yogis, when they come to that full meditation on Paramatma, can take up bhakti at that time. Right? And so, being on that platform, they would be liberated. You know, so then it'll be very easy to move forward quite nicely. Right? Or it can mean that he develops a spiritual form for the purpose of knowing the Supreme. Right? So either way it works. That's why the Vedic mantras are written as such. You can take it any, all these different aspects of philosophy, all the mimamsa, you can get from the same verses.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like that. Here Baladev Vidyabhushana asks, why is an account of the jiva's liberation found in the middle of a meditation on the Supersoul? The goal of the jiva's own perfection is the Paramatma. Upon joining the Paramatma, the jiva achieves his own true form and personality. Right? Because that's the true form and personality. Otherwise, before that, you have whatever is your conditioned form and personality. Right? But the true personality is the basis of servant of Krishna. Does that make sense? You know, just like, let's say, you have a dog, right? So dogs have a particular kind of personality, right? Then within that you have the specifics of a particular dog. Right? Does that make sense? So servant of Krishna is the general principle of the jiva. Then you'll have the specifics of the personality. Will then develop after that. Mm. That makes sense.
This is scenario in the spiritual world. I mean, first the servant, and then the personality develops.
Yes, because otherwise form is there, but what's the personality in connection with Krishna?
Mm-hmm.
You understand? So that's why then that attitude has to develop, and you develop that in association with the eternal associates. Right? So seeing their mood is then you develop that mood. So that's why the principle of associating with devotees is the most important element. Everything comes from that. So here, you know, our practice of sadhana bhakti develops because of that. But also on that uttama platform, prema develops because of the same thing. Right? And then that expression of prema, it develops based on the same thing. So it's always about associating with the devotees, because that's what Krishna's doing. He's associating with his devotees, right? There's not something else. Is that yes.
It was just reminding me, in logic we call that sambhav is inclusion, so that means that the higher rasas, conjugal parenthood, automatically include the lower ones. Servitude.
Yes, they already include.
Yeah.
And also you can take it in the, if you're looking at it from, because that's in the qualities they have, you can also look at it that the mood of service, let's say of braja, already includes the ways of expression of that mood of service in the five rasas. You understand? The five rasas are ways to express the braja mood of service.
Right.
You understand? So you can do it either way. Right. Like that. So that's the point. Mm-hmm. Yes, good point. What do you call it?
Sambhav.
Sambhav.
Yeah. Same thing with the Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. Each one includes, you know, the...
Okay,
you know.
Yes. Oh, really? Because I've only heard it used in verse. Like in Bengali, they'll say asambhav means it's impossible.
Oh. Yeah, yeah, asambhav means possible.
And so sambhav means it'll be possible or it's all included. Asambhav means it's not included.
It's not included in the possibilities.
Yeah, yeah. So that's interesting.
Joining Paramatma?
Joining means like putting together, like, you know, G.I. Joe or something.
That's what I'm curious about. The last sentence?
The last sentence. The last sentence means on the previous page, on page 11.
Yeah.
Okay, upon joining the Paramatma, the jiva achieves his own true form and personality. It means the Paramatma here, because the Upanishad is only referring to the Paramatma here in this case. So that means the Lord. Does that make sense? Because Paramatma means you're only seeing the Lord on his own without the devotees. You're seeing the Lord with the devotees, that's Bhagavan. So Paramatma himself is with his devotees. Right? So he's Bhagavan. But our perception of him is only part of it. Because then you're joining Paramatma. So then that means the Lord with the devotees. Is that okay? I guess it's a different level of, like, when you ask the devotee, oh, when did you join?
Yeah.
Funny you should ask. Yeah. Okay. So page, did we finish the page? Did we finish 11?
Yeah.
Okay. Page 12. The Bhagavatam says, the soul was never born and will never die, nor does it grow or decay. It is actually the knower of the youth, middle age, and death of the material body. It can thus be understood to be pure consciousness, existing everywhere at all times and never destroyed. Just as the life air within the body, although one becomes like many in contact with the various material senses, the soul appears to assume various material designations in contact with its material bodies. Srimad Bhagavatam 11:3-38, footnote 12. In this Srimad Bhagavatam passage, Pipalayana, Yogendra, instructs King Nimi to educate him about the nature of the Lord. The purpose is to learn to distinguish the self from the body. Right? Because if you want to know the Lord, who is transcendental, you first have to understand that you're not the body. That's why also these other philosophical religious systems will have a shortcoming, because they can't define the jiva, so how will they define the Lord? Mm-hmm. Right? Something as close as ourselves, it can't be defined. How will you define the Lord from which everything is coming? Mm-hmm. Right? Other than those very general terms. Mm-hmm. Right? So yeah. So here, as we see, he's the one means all these, from these terms you get all these other ideas. Existing everywhere at all times and never destroyed. So existing everywhere can either mean, because in connection with he's the knower of youth, middle age, and death, and assumes various material designations in contact with his material body. So he could be talking about one soul, in that the one soul goes through, you know, birth, death, old age, and disease, so sees all that, and the variety of life bodies that it will get in its transmigration through the material world. Or it can also be referring to the aspect of the jivas, that there's unlimited jivas, so they're everywhere at all times in all places. Mm-hmm. Right, so you can get both aspects, right? Because both. So the Vedas are very expert at with one statement meaning all those things. Right. In other words, if you can describe two things at once, generally the Veda will do that. Right, because it's just so more efficient. Because they're connected, so one naturally goes into the other. Right, because the jiva is there, he's going through this whole transmigration process. But why is that transmigration process there? Because all the jivas are here, and that's the desire. So therefore, the Lord arranges it. So the statement, the jivas are maintaining the universe. So we know that it's Garbhodakshay Vishnu who's doing that. So how would it say the jivas? Because it's only being maintained because the jivas are there. Just like there's a prison. Why is it being maintained? Right? Mm. Because it's full of prisoners. Right? I think Alcatraz, they don't maintain it anymore.
No.
Right? Because there's no prisoners in it. You understand? So the point is the material world is being maintained by the Lord because the jivas are here that want to take part in the material activities. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. So therefore, he's establishing that the jiva is there. Then you can understand the Lord who's beyond, who's the source of. Yes.
That's another that one use. Are there like detachment processes like from Buddhist vipassana?
But how will you? What will be the connection? Because the point is, it's just like if you want to make a connection, there has to be something common.
No, just for the detachment. If you know.
No. But the point is, are you actually detached? You know what I'm saying? You may be detached at one level. But it's just like this. If I say, okay, here, you can have an Apple, you know, or I'll give you an Apple computer. Which do you want? So is that detachment? You know what I'm saying? So the idea is that I will become nothing and this way I'll be happy. So once, who can do it? Those who are convinced that I'll be happier on that platform than on the platform of dealing with the material, you know, phenomena. That's all. It's not that they're developing actually a spiritual attitude. All it is that they're using a more refined, more sattvic material attitude. That's all. You know, just like those who go to the heavenly planets. So it's the same position. The person who wants to go to the heavenly planets also has to be detached. They have to do the yajna, they have to do everything exact, be very, very focused, you know, giving charity, do all the different things. It's great trouble.
But you learn about the duality, that's you should be.
No, but how is it learning about duality? Because the idea is it's all one. And ultimately it doesn't exist. Because in Buddhism, there is no duality because it's not here in the first place. So you really don't learn about duality. But when you understand like how the Upanishads approach, that you learn the soul, the nature of the soul, then you can see the duality between the soul and the material energy. But in Buddhism, or in impersonalism, there is no duality in this case because, though they talk about it, because the soul is illusion and the material energy is illusion. So they're one.
But you learn about that you shouldn't bother by cold and hot.
That is, by not bothering about cold and hot, you know, it means it's like polar bears would be great paramahamsas. You know what I'm saying? Like that. Or let's say they work on their own. So then let's take penguins, right? The other side. Right? They work in big groups. They have this whole system where, you know, hundreds of them get together. And they have this system where they shuffle through. You know, they just keep moving over until they get into the center of the circle so that the most warm, and then slowly, slowly, they works back out to on the outside. And that's what they do all day. You know, when there's a storm or something. So then they're working cooperatively. They're learning to, you know, tolerate, you know. So the point is this, that's not what makes human life. These are supportive of human life, but human life doesn't start until one understands that there is, you know, there is the Supreme. Atato Brahma Jigyasa.
Yes, but just as we can use Ayurveda, can we use a little part of this also?
Like, but why use theirs? Because they're only getting it from us.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? In other words, the Vedas are where it's from. Now, Buddha is there. He was following the Hindu thing. So what culture is he going to follow as a Buddhist? Right? Because he sits under a tree. You go out and beg from the local Hindus, right, from the Brahmins. How are you? Why would the concept of begging be there? Why would the concept of living under a tree be there? Right? Because that's already in the Vedic culture. Right? You know what I'm saying? It's not that Tibetans lived under a tree. Right? You know what I'm saying? So, where did it come from? Like that. Does that make sense? So, that's the difficulty, is that it's based on there. And then all his major preachers were all the big Brahmin scholars. So all it is they've just simply converted the culture into this atheistic philosophy. So it already has its origin here. So why use that? If someone's already a Buddhist, then fine. But the point is Buddhists can't give you these answers. They can't actually define it. Does that make sense? I'm just saying they can't, because how you say this one person, he was probably he was the most prominent Buddhist practitioner, like for 17, 18 years. You know, studied with big guy, did the whole thing, all the meditation and everything. And these questions he would ask, he couldn't get any answers. And he's talking to the biggest guys. But then when he heard, you know, the Vedanta philosophy, every question he was looking for could be summarized in a 5-minute discussion. Right? And so then he understood that, you know, this is where it's from. So there's nothing lacking here. You wouldn't have to. If you're already taking a Buddhist, then he continues in his Buddhist stuff. You give him the understanding. But if he's a devotee, why would one use Buddhist stuff? You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? Yes. Okay, 532. The soul, 53.2. The soul, or pure jiva, is never born, and because he has no birth, he is not subjected to the next stage of transformation, persistence. The soul also does not grow, and because he does not undergo bodily development, the notion that he creates byproducts is also denied. Because if he doesn't grow, then he's not producing any byproducts. Right? So the jiva is not dealing with any of this. Right? Because if he's born, then he has to maintain. But the point is he wasn't born, so he doesn't have to endeavor to maintain. I'm saying the body, you're born, you have to make a lot of endeavor to maintain it. Right? You don't feed it, then there's a problem. Right? So, therefore, the point of persistence. And then, since he doesn't grow, then there's no question of the soul, it makes other souls. Like that. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. So that's the, that, you know, yes.
Yes.
Here, the word he, indeed, means because. That word was indeed used up here. Means because. The phrase of those things unsteady means the appearance and disappearance of the bodies of a child, a young man, and so on. Right? So it's actually the knower of the youth, middle age, and death. Or else bodies in the forms of a demigod, a human, and so on. Right? So it can either mean within one body that there'll be these transformations, or the transformation from one body to the next. Okay, footnote 13. Baladeva Vidyabhushan states, there are six transformations. Birth, existence, growth, transformation, decline, and death. These do not exist in the jiva, so that's all within the body.
Existence, how to find that?
Existence means he's there. Well, you look him up in the phone book and go to his house, he's there.
Is that transformation?
Yeah, because before that body wasn't there.
That would be birth.
Yes, but then he has to exist, so you're always, that transformation is going on because you have to maintain it.
Okay.
Right? Growth, transformation, right? Decline, and death.
Yes. Anyway, then they don't exist anymore. Anyway.
Okay, yeah, that could work. That could work. Knower of the phases of time means witness of past, present, future. The meaning here is that a witness of various material conditions is not himself under those conditions. Right? Because then you're not a witness.
Yes.
Then, what is the unconditioned soul? The answer is that he is nothing but perception, or in other words, an embodiment of pure consciousness. How is he present? He is everywhere in the body and always going with it. So then here, the everywhere specifically means his conscious pervades the body. Yeah. 53.3. But we see consciousness of something blue fading and consciousness of something yellow arising in its place. Doesn't this mean that consciousness is impermanent? Didn't we just discuss this?
Getting back into it.
Yeah, you're coming back.
That's coming back. I didn't
just
die yet.
You think you're...
But, and why always blue and yellow? Where's the red?
Pink.
Huh? Pink? Yeah. No, that's right. Doesn't this mean that consciousness is impermanent? This is answered by the phrase, by the power of the senses. Consciousness is one and persistent. But by the power of the senses, it seems many. Right? Because you mentioned before from the Upanishad that the air is one entity. But within the body, it acts as five. Right? But otherwise, air is one principle. Right, so then consciousness is one principle, and then all these other variations are transforms. They come and go, but consciousness itself remains. Right, because they're making it that if the blue is there, then if the yellow comes, it's changed, so it's a different consciousness. Right, so then you'd end up with something like a goldfish.
Yeah.
And someone the other day told me actually their memory is a little longer than 3 seconds, whatever it is. You know. Maybe that's how long they appreciate the environment or something like that. Yes.
Now, I used to hear a long time ago that consciousness is transferred through the blood, throughout the body.
Yeah, it means for the awareness of the body. That's how you can feel, like that. But at the same time, when one is conscious, there's other aspects also. Means the airs and these like this. So there's an awareness like that, the subtle body like that. But the point is why you can feel there is because the consciousness goes to the blood. Does that make sense? That's why his blood goes, the consciousness goes. But it just means it goes back to, just the living entity. Okay, transformations of consciousness into forms of blueness and so on come and go, but consciousness itself does not. The distinction between that which comes and goes and the point from which it comes or to which it goes supplies the first argument for the transcendental nature of the soul. Right, so the same argument we would use, that points out there's a soul because there's always consciousness. The second argument proceeds from the distinction between the seer and seen, footnote 14. Srila Jiva Goswami gives two different types of arguments from the words of Pipalayanaya. Pipalayana.
people are in irons, how it's used in the yajna.
Right.
And
two, yeah.
The dative?
I guess it just means that it's to him.
Srimad
Bhagavatam 11.338. Okay. To distinguish the soul from the material body. The first argument is based on the changes occurring in the material body. We see the changes in the course of time, yet we do not think that we ourselves have changed. We know ourselves to be the same person, since the attributes of changelessness and transformation cannot be attributed to the same object. The unchanging soul must be distinct from the changing body.
So that means probably someone, devotees mentioned something about Prabhupada, you know, that he's older. He says, well, you know, that's how you perceive, but I don't feel older.
The second argument is based on the distinction between the perceiver and the perceived. The body and mind cannot be the observer because they are objects of perception. Thus, the perceiver, the soul, must be different from them. Yeah, because you can perceive the mind, perceive the body.
So then you're not.
Okay. Okay, so the distinction between what comes and goes and what is seer and seen. An analogy to the soul's remaining steady among unsteady things is found in the words beginning just as the life air. Jiva Goswami refers once again to the kshanika, vijnana, bodies. To them, knowledge is not eternal. Rather, it becomes blue sometimes, yellow at other times. Is that meaning affected by the weather? Or in the winter it becomes blue and summer it becomes yellow? Or?
Krishna's dhoti or Krishna's upper body skin.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's it. That could work. Jiva explains that the momentary consciousness of which they speak is actually changes in the mental state. It is produced by the senses interacting with the external world. Consciousness itself is constant. Otherwise, how are you able to be aware of that or be able to discuss it? Vedanta explains that when a person looks at an object, it creates a particular mental state called vritti. This vritti is perceived by the soul. The mental state is not itself the perceiver. Right, so that's the point about the mind is separate. Is the mind is only where that perception is
displayed.
Yeah, experienced.
In the Patanjali Sutras, there's that one.
A little louder.
In the Patanjali Sutras, it says Chitta Nirodha Vritti. That's the goal of yoga practice, is to eliminate all those disturbances in the mind and just become, you know, like meditate on the candle flame.
Okay. Still, that's something.
Yeah.
I mean, in theory, they should be able to meditate on nothing.
Yeah.
Right? But, you know.
Yeah.
Like that. But it doesn't. So. Yeah.
Keeps them off the streets.
Yes, it does. Like that. Okay. The Buddhists, however, lacking all knowledge of the soul, mistake this vritti, which is non-eternal and undergoes changes at every moment, to be the real consciousness. Right? Yes. So they're thinking that the consciousness is happening in the mind. So therefore, that transformation means the consciousness is changing. Because the Buddhists don't even know that there is soul.
Yeah.
Right? It means because their point is that if everything, means if everything's nothing, there is no soul. So the Mayavadis will also basically say there's no soul because there's only Brahman, but that's the supreme soul, so that's soul. Mm-hmm. Right? So it's just a matter of between the Mayavadis and the Buddhists, the word soul and nothingness, these are interchangeable.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just whether you're using non-Vedic or Vedic definition, that's all.
Yeah, it's kind of like he was asking can we adopt their Abhideya, but there's some Bandha, they have no concept of, you know, the soul, the intelligence, the mind, false ego.
Yeah, because it's all illusions, so they don't even bother getting involved.
Yeah.
Like, while within the in Vedic, then you're going to find they get involved,
yeah,
you know, to a very great degree.
Yeah.
So there isn't a whole lot to gain from what they talk about. It's so much easier to describe it and explain it and use it from the Vedic perspective.
Very often in discussing with these individuals, you hear them say it's not that simple. But it is.
It is that simple.
Yeah, that
means that what they're looking for is that simple.
Yes.
The explanation of it can be as sophisticated as the person is able to accommodate. Like that. Right, because as we were mentioning before, Shankar was explaining, the consciousness of the soul reflects off of the intelligence and then onto the sense object. Right, so you're seeing a reflection. So that's why it's changing. It is what's observed. It means the soul is observing that reflection. Right? So it's not that the mind is observing.
We had that last year also.
Yeah, that was when we discussed it. It was part of Shankya.
Yeah.
Shankya just explained, because that's all it does is analyze and break down. So it would break down how exactly the living entity is perceiving the world.
Uh-huh.
But it ends at that. That's only the mechanics of it. But the point is how is there, means that there is form to see, that there is the sense that can see, and that there is the power of the seeing process. That's because of the Lord.
Yes.
So the Lord desires to see. Therefore, then eyes are created, form is created, you know, fire is created, and the sense of seeing. And so that way, he's seeing everything. So because he's seeing everything, therefore we can be involved in that.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Just like the parent is on the, the deck of the, you know, boat cruising in the Caribbean. So they're able to see that. Now the child is there with them.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the child is therefore able to see it. The child wouldn't see it on its own.
So it's actually being done to us.
It's being done, means we're actually being seen,
yes,
in our seeing.
Yes.
It means we're seeing that we're also being seen in that process of seeing. You know, and what we're seeing is the Lord, it's also seeing us. You know, so there's a whole lot going on that you don't necessarily want to get too involved in. That's when you get down to the canon. That's why the tattva is what it is, and it breaks down our whole concept of material life.
Yes.
But in the spiritual world, then it's not a major element, because you don't have to. There is no duality there,
mm-hmm.
So you don't. There's not a difference between the servant, the service, and who's being served,
mm-hmm. Yes.
Right? So they're able to interact nicely because it's all based on affection.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to, mechanics aren't what's important.
Ashra and Visha is changing,
yes,
back and forth.
Yes, like that. It means ultimately it's Krishna's the Visha, the Ashra, because they're the shelter of that particular kind of affection. Here it's always the changing element. Things just, these Ashra Visha is always changing because everybody's trying to be the Visha and make everybody else into the Ashra. That's why someone wants, if you want to enjoy, then you have to make everybody the way you want them, because then they'll be the proper ashray for you to enjoy. Right? While the Vedic sense is you don't bother with that. You just change yourself and you're happy. Right? But on the material, it's required that you try to change everyone else, because if you're the supreme enjoyer, then everybody else has to be enjoyable. That means they have to be in line with what you would, how you would like the enjoyment to go. So that's why he says that it's not working for me. It means everybody else is not. But in the Upanishadic context, you don't need the others for it to work for you, because it's about the soul. It's not about the condition.
Yeah. There's no loss of identity.
Yeah, there's no loss of identity. But for the impersonalist and the Buddhist, the loss of the identity is what they're looking for.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like, how you say?
Binge drinking.
Yes, like that. Binge drinking.
Oh.
You know, you get so, yeah, I'm just trying to think. That there must be some cultured words for it, because I only know slang and stuff. But, you know, it means, in other words, the intoxication is so great that you don't even know who you are. So it appears to be that's their state they're trying to get to. But because dealing with, what do you call it?
Idiots.
Reviling the reviling the Vedas is part of it, is a subsection of intoxication. Mm-hmm. Like that. Like that. So when you go against the Vedas, it gives you the same effect as intoxication does in the way of sinful reaction.
Okay.
Yeah. Right? They're in the same category. Okay. Right? Like that. Like, because you're already in an illusion and then you get drunk to and further that illusion. So that the Veda is what clears the illusion. So therefore, you go against the Veda, and that will be to increase illusion, that double illusion. So it's like compared to intoxication.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Makes sense.
Okay. Okay. The mental state is not itself the perceiver, right? So we're perceiving, right? We're saying, no, but with the mind I'm perceiving, or intelligence. No. That is what is reflected off of. The soul is what's seeing. The Buddhists, however, lacking all knowledge of the soul, mistake this vritti, which is not eternal and undergoes change at every moment, to be the real consciousness, right? So they take the mind and all that to be. Baladeva Vidyabhushan gives the reality. The jiva is also a knower. This is like the sun, which is self-revealing object, which reveals other things. Knowledge itself is eternal, since it is related to the sarup of jiva. Perception of the blue takes place through the sense and pranas. The functions, sense-catching objects, taking the form of blue, etc., appear and then disappear. Okay. Right, yeah. Because the sun reveals other things, it's self-revealing. So the soul, therefore, it's through the soul that they're revealed. But they're always then changing and everything like that.
So they can't distinguish. They can't distinguish.
No, because they don't accept the soul. So what does that leave you with? Exactly. So subtle is mind and intelligence and all that. But the perception of it is not in the intelligence. It's the mind. The mind is then what is judging what's there. Defining, just like we were saying, is that the sense, it's not that, because the sense analyzes what's there. It means in the way of, these are what's happening. But the mind actually has to then take that and then define what it is. You know, like we were saying, is that thing of Australian Aboriginals, when Captain Cook came into the Byron Bay with his boats, right? Then they couldn't see the boats because they didn't have any concept of boats. But they knew water and how water acted, so they could see the water was acting differently and it shouldn't be acting like that. It can only act like that if something was there. And then from that they can perceive that something's there, but they don't know what it is, but something is there. Yeah. You know, and then when the guys got off the boat and started shooting at them, then, you know.
Something was definitely there.
Does that make sense? So the mind has to be able to perceive. But the thing is, it's only taking those elements that are there. The soul is what perceives off the mind. So the Buddhists are simply left with the mind. And so that's always changing, always this and that. So it wouldn't technically be a good... The sadhana of a Buddhist would not be an enjoyable experience, because you're just dealing with all the insanity of the changing of the mind. You don't have any solace of the soul.
So that's why they stare into a wall to kind of counter it.
I guess so. To kind of make the mind peaceful. You know, it's like, you know, sitting in the corner when you're bad. You know, so it's kind of like voluntary solitary. Yeah. So, I mean, there's got to be something wrong there. You know, nobody wants that.
No.
You know that. I think that's from what I've understood. That's the biggest threat. You know, they don't care if they beat you or this or that. But if they put you in solitary, then the big, big guys will, okay, then they'll behave. The point is further clarified with the example of the life air. Air is one, but air within the body has various names, such as prana, apana, samana, and so on, according to the function it performs. It's life air, but when it moves in and out, up and down, contraction, it expands, then it's given this different name. But otherwise, it's just the same life air. Right. Similarly, the soul is one, but it manifests consciousness, which in the body appears ever changing on account of the senses. For example, cow's milk will give rise to different mental states when perceived with different senses. To the eyes it is white, to the tongue it is sweet, and so on. So it appears that it's all these different elements, but it's still just one thing.
Yes.
So this soul, as it deals with the world through the senses, it appears that there's always these constant changing elements. But actually, it's still the soul's the same. So it is only the mental state affected by the varieties of sense perception that appears and disappears or undergoes changes, not the self. Because the appearance and disappearance means you're thinking about one thing, then that goes, and then you're thinking about something else, and it goes. So it's constantly transforming. Right, so that's the crux that these Buddhists are, you know, making their stand on. But they make that stand because they don't know their soul, right? So for them, consciousness is the mind. So according to their philosophy, it would appear to be correct, but it's not, in that the consciousness is the nature of the soul, not of the mind. The mind's only able to perceive because the consciousness of the soul is there.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, this mind is dead matter also.
Mechanical thing.
Yeah. You know, just like a mirror is dead matter, but you can reflect light.
Mm.
Right? Like that. But so, you know, when we say no, but so many things can be understood or seen. No, but that's just like a mirror. It's also dead. It's you don't put anything in front of it, it doesn't reflect anything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, it's not that it's doing this on its own.
Mm-hmm.
So the soul is just observing that. If one's left-handed, one's actually writing forward. If one's right-handed, you're actually writing backwards.
Yeah.
So when you're pushing, the other one's pulling. Okay. What was that point? Okay. In the next section, Srila Jiva Goswami gives further logic to help distinguish the self from the body.
What does it mean whenever a device known as mind is like a clear lake?
Clear lake, because it means it's perceiving what you perceive. It's all, you know, connected to Krishna, so it's peaceful.
Okay.
This constant transformation of the mind, that's what's giving trouble to the living entity, and that's the idea that all these philosophies are trying to remove, right? You know, especially it means at least the jnanakanda, right? The karmakanda is just to make a nicer situation. Then, you know, like if you're in a nice place, you feel nice and peaceful. So you just make everything nice. That way you'll do it. So that's what everybody's trying to deal with. But more aggressively then will be the those who are it's jnana. So then they're trying to remove the phenomena, right? So, that so the devotee's mind is peaceful, or like the lake, you know, it's just clear and nice. It's because when everything, the senses bring in information, only the elements that are chosen are what can be used in Krishna's service. Right? And then the identity is as Krishna's servant. So therefore what one does is connected to Krishna. And because Krishna is you know, peacefulness. Right? Therefore the devotee is. Does that make sense?
And conditioned soul has a tendency to be an illusion. That means the identity.
No, tendency is means he has, because of being tatasta and being small, he can come under illusion. But it's not that that's his tendency.
Right.
His tendency is just to be in the middle. But you know, if you stick something on the edge of something, it'll fall off one way or the other. So the idea is it should fall off on the internal potency side rather than the external potency side.
Yes. Had to say about the samskaras. The samskaras, they only come into play whenever the mind is making a decision, or is it before that?
No, it means it, what you choose to make a decision about, that's what samskara.
Right now.
Right? What you decide to do, that's based on ego, your identity.
Yes.
Right? It means senses are pulling in so much information, but depending upon what's important to you, you only pull those ones. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, yes.
You know, it's just like, you know, the
like on the train when he was going past.
Yes, you just catch that one. You know, because otherwise, so many things are out there. People are standing there, luggage is there, carts are there. You know, the Moody Waller was there. You know, but then the young girl is there. Then he catches that. So the mind just catches what elements that you want, because all the senses are working. So you could pull in from anywhere, but due to some scar, your previous impressions, then you pull in certain ones that you feel you'll get the best benefit from. You know, benefit in the way of experience or, you know, things like that. So that's where some people, scary things they pull in, you know. Or so one thing, the kid is there with the, he's walking along and he sees the some mud, right? And he takes a stick. You know, he sees the mud, goes, ew.
Yeah.
Right? Then he takes the stick and pokes it, ew. And then he's moving it, you know, ew. Then next we see him inside the mud, you know, the mud all over him, ew. You know, so the whole thing is they like yucky stuff. So therefore, then, you know, here's some, so they get involved. So that's why eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. Defending is fear, you know. So that whole side, you know, but it's that makes sense.
Yes.
So everybody has a thing that they're into.
Yes.
You know, or combination. Yeah.
Right. So is it possible to engage all of this?
Yes. That's what the prescribed duties are. Does that make sense? Because prescribed duties say what you should eat, when you should eat it, how much you should eat. You know, how you should, you know, sit, how you should serve, how you should, you know, all these different things connected with it, right? Sleeping also, then there's rules on that. You know, like we sleep east or south, you know, like this, you know, like that. Then mating, then that also is defined, right? It's only done with a legally married partner, right? And then the actual purpose is it creates children, right? No? And then fearing is then having involved yourself in the other three, especially in mating, then fear comes up because then you want to maintain it. So you're afraid of loss. You know, does that make sense? So either you're defending it because it's dynamic, or you don't know how to defend it or that, but at least you can feel afraid. You know, and feel bad and lament and, you know, all these different things you can do. So at least the experience is there, even if you can't do anything. So all these are maintained. So then the whole point is that fearing, the point is then you surrender to the Lord. Right? He's the one who takes care of these things. Right? There's things that you're supposed to do to protect yourself. You know what I'm saying? So all these are defined by Scripture. So you perform these things, and they become engaged. And they're performed to please Krishna, then they become spiritualized. Does that make sense? That's the whole dynamic of the Vedic culture. It's meant to engage everything within human, you know, the human context, right? You know, so in the Vedic, it's very easy. The detail of it is very nice, easily able to be connected. But using non-Vedic, then you generally have to go back more to a principle. You know, it's kind of like, well, they call it music, you know. Does that make sense? But it wouldn't be defined as music in detail. But, you know, in concept, people are accepting it in that way, so it's dealt with in that way. So it has that use within the society. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. Summary of text 54. Some scars, you know. Something came up, text 54, where are you?
Like the police car.
Yeah, that was it. In this Anucheda, Srila Jiva Goswami gives the follow-up to the previously cited verse by Pipalayana. Pipalayana Yogendra. With it, he extracts two more arguments which prove that the soul is in fact distinct from the body and from Brahman, or the supersoul. Both the Buddhists and the Mayavadis claim that cognition is acquired in the conditioned state and then abandoned in the unconditioned state. According to the Bhagavatam, this verse, however, whether bound or liberated, the soul is eternally changeless and has the quality of cognition as its essential nature. Right, so Satchidananda is what we're meaning as essential nature. Text 54. Expanding this analogy, the next Bhagavatam verse teaches how to perceive the changeless soul when the senses, mind, and false ego dissolve. Because right? Otherwise, that's the point, is that when the external, the upadis, are gone, then how do you perceive the soul? Because the Mayavadis and the Buddhists, they can't.
No.
Right, so then here's a method of how you can. The spirit soul is born in many different species of life within the material world. Some species are born from eggs, others from embryos, others from the seeds of plants and trees, and others from perspiration. But in all species of life, the prana, or vital air, remains unchanging and follows the spirit soul from one body to another. Similarly, the spirit soul is eternally the same despite its material condition. We have practically experienced this. When we are absorbed in deep sleep, without dreaming, the material senses become inactive, and even the mind and false ego are merged into a dormant condition. But although the senses, mind, and false ego are inactive, one remembers upon awaking that he, the soul, was peacefully sleeping. Right, so that means the soul is perceiving that, because the senses and other things can't, the mind, all that can't. Mm-hmm. So that's, he gives the example, that's how you can understand the soul is beyond, you know, and how you can perceive the soul. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So it's a very nice, because the point is why these? Because the mind, the false ego, and the senses, that's the whole process that's going on, right? The senses pull in information, the mind chooses from that. Then after analyzation, then according to false ego, you make a decision, and then again the senses are engaged. Right? So that's the whole process of reasoning goes on with this combination of these. So then when that's all removed, then technically you shouldn't be able to reason or think or analyze. But upon awakening from deep sleep, you can say that you were peacefully sleeping.
Yes.
Right? So that's the soul. Here, andeshu, among eggs, means in species born from eggs. Peshishu, among fetuses, means in species born from wombs. Right? Because among eggs, because there's so many varieties of eggs. There's so many, does that make sense?
Yeah.
So, like that.
Yeah.
Tarushu, among trees, means in plant species. Avinishchiteshu, among the indeterminate, means in species born from perspiration. And upadhavati, runs after, means follows. Right? So the soul is going in these bursts through these. So here we see is that the Vedic point is always you work from the principle, because otherwise you say, okay, from this tree, but what about that tree? Yeah, that tree also. And then this one? Yeah, yes, that also. What about that bush there? That's not exactly like a tree. Yeah, yeah, that also. But what about that? That's a creeper. Does it also, you know, he said like that? And so then you go through how many plant life? What is it? 2 million or something? Like that. You spend a long time doing this, right? So that's the idea, is that one catches the principle. So one focuses on understanding the principle. Then you go back to the detail. Then if there's a question that arises there, it's a practical question. Because then it's a matter of how to apply this into there. Right? Mm-hmm. So we see here is that they just, it's not even, you know, that we say from eggs, we just think of, you know, a particular egg or something. But here, among eggs means all the variety. So it even better describes it. Right?
Maharaj, did you say something's born from sweat? Perspiration?
Yeah.
I mean,
this is how Rexona becomes rich.
I'm sorry, this is a stupid question, but...
It takes 7 billion times 2. No?
14 billion?
Yeah, so 14 billion underarms. That's good scope.
That's what we do.
Otherwise, why does it smell? Unless somebody's making a smell.
Oh, you mean bacteria?
Yeah, so that's they're born by sweat.
Okay. No, I just heard that mosquitoes are born by sweat.
Maybe. Somebody's sweating. so it works out. But the point is there's a huge amount of living entities that are very small, you know. So that's how they're born. You know, if you wash your hands, they're not born. But if you don't wash your hands, they're born. Does that make sense? Okay. Yes? No? Okay. What are you doing? The soul cannot be directly perceived by pratyaksha, empiric means, or proved by anuman, logic based on faulty sensory evidence. It can, however, be understood by hearing from the greatest authority of knowledge, Srimad Bhagavatam. This verse gives two examples by which to understand the jiva, who is described in Bhagavad Gita as amazing. Footnote 15. The fact that the atomic soul is within the body of a gigantic animal, in the body of a gigantic banyan tree, and also in the microbic germs, millions and billions of which occupy only an inch of space, is certainly very amazing. Men with poor fund of knowledge and men who are not austere cannot understand the wonders of the individual atomic spark of spirit. Bhagavad Gita 2:26 purport. Right, so here, poor fund of knowledge and not austere, right, so they're not committed to their duties in that. Mm-hmm. Right? Or, you know, they don't have proper Vedic understanding. Mm-hmm.
I thought we could prove the soul through anuman. Mm-hmm.
But it's not through the senses. Like here we saw here is that you have the element, but he's giving the second one. Because the point is they're going from life to life. Mm. They're following through all these different species. Mm. So it's the soul that's doing that.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Because the point... Because then you could say, because we give that, so most people will be comfortable with that. But some may say, no, but when the soul goes, we say the soul, that's the mind that's also going. So it could be the mind. But then we point this out, is that when all that is inactive, one is able to remember. So that means, remembrance means the consciousness of something. So that consciousness is the soul.
Yes. Right?
The first example concerns the vital air. The second concerns the jiva's three psychological states. Regarding the first point, Baladev Vidyabhushana comments,
In the example, the prana does not change since it remains in one form in various bodies. The life air goes into the various bodies, but it remains unchanged, although it seems to have changed. For example, the life air of an ant and that of an elephant appears to be of different sizes, but is constitutionally the same, right? Because the principle is still works the same. It's not about size, right? Similarly, the soul, although changeless, appears to undergo changes based on the various states and shapes of the body. The soul remains steady and unaffected in so many variegated forms. Why should we believe, as the impersonalists do, that the soul eventually ceases to exist? Right? Because their whole idea is that all these forms, these are what is the cause of the problem. So the problem is the identification with the mind. So one can have that peaceful mind one's looking for by connecting it to service to the Lord and His service, right? But they're going about a faulty mechanical process or an atheistic process, in that they will come to that state without acknowledging the Lord, right? Or permanently acknowledge, like the yogis may temporarily acknowledge. Right, but then having seen the super soul, then they may want to merge. So that's not a permanent. Right? Or the smartest, they may worship the form of the Lord and then give that up. Okay. So that's an example of how the soul is moving through the bodies. Right? It means just like showing that the life air takes all these different aspects. So therefore, the soul is also, how you say, that same principle. Mm-hmm. Okay. 54.2. Having shown the changelessness of the analogous object, the life air, the verse goes on to show the changelessness of the object to which the analogy applies. Right. So you're using an analogy like the life air, because if you can understand that principle, the life air is within all these different bodies, but it's still the same principle, right? But it appears to change. So that's the whole point. It appears there's change, but there's not. The soul doesn't change. And then he gives this, then the next. Okay, then that's to the soul. How does it show this? When the soul is awake, it seems to be undergoing changes. When all the senses are asleep, the ego retains sensory impressions. But when one is in, because ego, sensory perceptions, asleep because you have dreams and all these other things. Right? When all the senses, but when one is in deep sleep and the senses and the ego are temporarily merged in disillusion, the changeless soul remains steady. How do we know this? We know it from the understanding that when the seat of tainted consciousness, the subtle body, is unmanifest, no upadis remain to impose changes upon the soul. Right? So it's interesting, if we remember in Manu, it mentions that when the Lord sleeps, all the jivas go into the Lord and sleep, and then they come out. But it also, if I remember, it also means when the soul is sleeping, that deep sleep means he merges back into the Lord.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Like that. And that's why it's so peaceful sleep.
Yeah.
Because when he doesn't do that, then he's just, reliving all whatever he's thought about in the day and everything.
Yes.
And it gets weird.
Yes.
This is what woke up. This had a combination of, when you walk down these like really narrow shop things, that both sides are shops, but the top is also kind of covered with this and that and everything. That they were going down that, but it was shops, but it was a train. How big's a train? That was weird.
Yeah.
And then, people get lost in the whole thing. You're on a train, how do they get lost? Right?
So that was going on.
Yeah, so that's the point, is it's not there. So Jiva Goswami is here referencing the three basic psychological states of Jiva. Jagara, external wakefulness. So that's sattvic, body, mind, false ego, or active. Supti, or swapna, dreaming. Rajasic, body inactive, mind and false ego active. Shushupti, dreamless, deep sleep. Tamasic, body, mind and false ego are inactive. In Jagara, consciousness, flows along the subtle channel of the mind through the senses to the sense objects. In Swapna, the mind is active and engaged, not with the sense objects, but with the memory of them. Right? So therefore it can merge anything together. So the senses, you can't merge things together, really. You know, you're kind of limited to what they do. They're operated by intelligence, so they make this distinction.
Yeah.
But in dream state, then the mind can do whatever it likes.
Interesting, because the rajasic predominance of rajogun, and that means the creative.
Yes, the creative. So yeah, yeah. So you create all kinds of yeah, wild stuff.
In Denmark, we have some mushrooms that have the same effect.
Yes, but somehow or another, the psychological state would be tamasic.
Yeah, I mean, the Vikings were getting it done, but
they won a lot of battles with those
yeah?
stuff.
Yeah.
Also, yes. In Swapna, the mind is active and engaged, but not with the sense object, but with the memory of them. In Sushupti, the three components of the subtle body are dormant.
Mm-hmm.
Footnote 16. At this time, the mind enters into the puritat nerve in the heart. 72,000 subtle nerves of perception, known as hita, expand from the heart and converge at a junction with a single nerve, the puritat. When the self is deeply asleep and not aware of anything, he has become detached from contact with the hita nerves and entered the puritat. Brihad Aranyaka Upanishad 2.1.19. Okay, so that gives the mechanical.
Yes.
What's happening? Okay. Yeah.
When someone is put to sleep by artificial means like anesthesia and things like that, does it fall in the category of time?
And it can be either. I've heard people say they can't remember anything, and I can remember people talking about how they see all kinds of amazing stuff.
Out of body experiences.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's all kinds of.
They do a bad job.
Yeah, really bad. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Because look at it. Is it 5-2? Is the other way? It stops. You see it for that moment. You go, what time? Then you have to wait.
It's a very long second.
Yes.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki jai, Jai Nitai Gaurav Premanand ki jai.